It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. President Joe Biden across the pond. Pew Research Center comes out with a poll, a survey of folks in 12 countries across the globe. The sentiment today, America's back. In fact, they found that in those 12 countries, 75% approval rating. That's up from the former guy who was at 17%. So different worlds. We're viewed differently across the globe. But the Pew poll actually, you know, went a little bit deeper. They asked the question, do you think the U.S. president is well qualified? Well, back when they asked about Trump in 2016, only 16% of the folks across the globe thought that Donald Trump was well qualified. 77% now say Joe Biden is well qualified. Yeah, he was vice president for 8 years. He's got a leg up here. Do you think the U.S. president is a strong leader? This was one of the higher points on the positive for Trump. 46% globally said yes. Biden has topped that. 62% of folks globally say that Joe Biden is a strong leader. Do you think the U.S. president is dangerous? 72% across the globe said yes, Donald Trump is dangerous. 14% for Joe Biden. And the top one, the one that, you know, I don't know how it's only 90%. But do you think the U.S. president is arrogant? 90% said yes of Trump. Just 13% of Joe Biden. I'm surprised at that because I don't see Biden as arrogant at all. But 90% seems low to me. It seems a little low. But that means that even the conservatives across the globe, people who would identify with our domestic fascist terrorists, that even they're going, yeah, he's arrogant. So there you have it, as our president is across the pond. For the G7, pledged to come up with 1 billion vaccines to help vaccinate people across the globe, which is hysterical because here you've got so many people saying, well, we're never taking a vaccine. And they're pushing general assemblies and legislatures across the country to ban it. In fact, you know, I look at Texas and Florida, which is just crazy. You know, this is one of those weird moments for me. Because, you know, these were the people who, you know, you can't tell business what to do. You can't tell, you know, property owners what to do. You can't mandate, the government can't mandate things. They're literally saying that if you're a store owner or you a business owner, that you can't mandate that your employees get vaccinated or prove that they've been vaccinated. But oddly enough, on the other side, if one of your employees is gay and wants to have a cake, no cake for you, which is just, well, again, like a lot of conservative ideology, very inconsistent. Now, some interesting news. There is another bipartisan group in the U.S. Senate. This time you've got the Gang of Ten. You've got the five Republicans, Romney, Portman, Collins, Cassidy, and Murkowski. The five Democrats, Sinema, Manchin, of course, Shaheen, Werner, and Tester. They claim they have come up with a transportation bill, an infrastructure bill. They've come up with some spending. They're eyeing about $579 billion in new infrastructure spending, $1 trillion plan, which is getting closer to what Joe Biden wanted. Problem here, the Republicans have said no. No tax increases. Nothing. Now, before I get into that, because this is the big part of it for me, you got five Republicans. That's great. That's great. Where are the other five coming from? I mean, this is my problem. This is where I think Biden has to go, well, wait a second. Who are the other five? Bring the other five along. And this is where Manchin and Sinema, and good for them, they brought five to the room. This is where they're playing into the McConnell Republican playbook of yeah, we're going to negotiate forever. There's a bipartisan chance, and look, I hope there is, because you know, on a certain level, infrastructure is not partisan. It never has been. I don't know how we've gotten to this moment where we can't go, yeah, we won't fix our roads. I don't remember when that became a bad thing. So this should be a 75 vote kind of thing. Sadly, it's not. And we know why. And that's because anything that gets done will shine positively on Joe Biden and the Democrats come 2022. And this is all about the election. So what they're going to do is they're going to stall and delay and do all this stuff as long as they can. So that in the moment that it's inevitable that Democrats go, well, we have to move this through budget reconciliation, it's later in the year. And if it's later in the year, you get no boost this year. There are no projects that begin. There's no road. There's no construction. No bridges get built. None of that stuff happens because we haven't allocated the funding for it yet. So they can push it off into the fall where it starts next year, where people aren't going to quite notice it and all they're going to be is ticked off because they're going to see orange cones everywhere. They got a better chance of winning in 2022. This is, you don't need a crystal ball. You don't need to be a rocket scientist or a genius or even all that intelligent. Because look, the GOP's figured this out. This is their plan. This is the MO. It's what they've done. It's who they are. Simple stuff. But you've got the gang of five, really. Nobody's identified the other five that are going to come along. And maybe they're out there. Maybe Joe Manchin has the crystal ball and he's figured it out. But for me at this moment, okay, a $1 trillion plan is better than what Shelley Moore Capito came forth with, which was a lot less. Started off at $150 billion, which, you know, Biden started off, what was it, like $2.2 trillion, and then moved his way down to $1.7 and all the way down again. And now the Republicans have come out and said, well, there's no way we're going to raise taxes. Not going to raise taxes on the wealthy. And this is one of those things where there's something that's kind of crazy, because this should be popular. The infrastructure bill is very popular. You ask average citizens, you ask working class folks, hey, do we need to rebuild our infrastructure? Do we need to invest in broadband technology? Do we need to invest in better airports and better ports and better transit systems? Yes, overwhelmingly, yes, we need to do these things. But there's something about going, well, how are we going to pay for it? Republicans are going, no, make those poor people pay for it. And there's something about taxes, something that we in the working class majority absolutely agree on. And that's simply that the wealthy will lie, cheat, and lobby their way out of paying them. It's that simple. You know, I have conversations. I'm fortunate that I'm in the position that I'm in. I have conversations with people of every political stripe, liberal to conservative, sane to kook pot, everywhere in between, all of the spectrum. And they all agree that our tax code is working exactly the way it's supposed to allow the uber wealthy to hoard as much cash as they possibly can. And you've got a political party, the Republicans, who are hell-bent on ensuring that the pledge that they took, because they all took the Grover Norquist anti-tax pledge, we shall never, never, ever, ever raise taxes on the uber wealthy. Fees and all kinds of costs on working people, on we in the working class majority, absolutely, we're going to fee them to death. And Mitt Romney, the king of that, while he was governor, never raised taxes in the state of Massachusetts, but did raise fees and costs on citizens 500 times. So that's the MO. We know it. And the thing that gets me is you have these Republicans who have literally sworn an oath that they take so seriously. And the oath to not raise taxes on the wealthy, they hold more sacred, more dear, more close to their heart than the oath they take to uphold and defend the Constitution of this nation and to defend and build our nation here at home. It's really quite remarkable. Now, understand, you know, this is not new. I mean, it's not. This is who the Republican Party has been for a very long time. And our tax code is working exactly as it's supposed to. We can be angry, We can be ticked off that the wealthy don't pay their fair share. We can be ticked off as today we find out that Jeff Bezos got one of the child tax credits that was supposed to be for people who make under $100,000 a year. He was while he was a multi billionaire, he was able to take that tax credit because our system is working exactly how it's supposed to. Bezos owns stock. He owns stock in Amazon. Owns a pretty sizable chunk. That's where his wealth's at. If he doesn't sell that stock, he doesn't realize the income, and we don't tax him. And when he does sell it and he does realize the profit, we tax him at a lower rate than most people who have to show up and punch a clock 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, and to support their families. Again, inherently unfair, but it is what it is. Exactly how the system is meant to work. Reward wealth, punish work. So they don't, the wealthy, they own massive amounts of stock, long-term stock that they don't sell. They borrow money against. They literally go and they borrow money, pay the interest rates that they get to deduct most of the time. So they don't have what we would consider real income. And this is the thing that gets me, because the Republican Party as a whole has done such a great job of clouding the issues of taxes in this country. You know, it's the death tax. We can't have an inheritance tax on wealthy people. Yet that's how they end up paying the taxes that they didn't pay for an entire lifetime. But I digress. They have gone and attacked at every opportunity. Because look, it's what the GOP does. They attack the weak. They attack things that can't defend itself. And this is part of that. You may remember, well, you know, the IRS was going after conservative groups. And they hammered that through their messaging machine. Hammered it time and time again. They're only going after conservatives. They're only going after us. When you go back and you look at it, they went after everybody. So when Republicans have an opportunity to, well, neuter the IRS, they do. They did it during the George W. Bush years. They did it during the Trump years. The idea is, well, we can't go after the rich people. We don't put resources into the IRS to go after those rich people when they cheat and they take a tax break that was meant for work, for the working class of this country. We don't have the resources to go after them. And, you know, again, I remember during the Bush years, them cutting the investigative arm of the IRS, who went after wealthy taxpayers or wealthy tax dodgers. Same thing during the Trump years. And what we find out is where they stopped investigating the uber wealthy, they went after the ultra poor. Because, you know, those, and this is the ironic part of all this. You know, Mississippi is one of the states that goes after the most people for tax abuses. And it's poor people they go after. And they go after them for the very tax break that Jeff Bezos got. The billionaire, multiple times over, got a tax break, and he was safe. Nobody's looking at his tax return, but that poor single mother who got the tax break that maybe she might have been on the border of, boy, we're going to go get her in a big way. Don't want those poor people cheating the taxes. The reason I bring this up is because we're in this moment where we got to pay for stuff. You got people whining, complaining, screaming, hey, we're going into debt. We can't pay for anything. Part of the things that we need to do is go get the money. Now, you've got Republicans who are losing their minds over the fact that somebody leaked some IRS data that said, hey, our billionaire class, they're not paying their share. In fact, we're paying them in some cases. And we should be collectively outraged. And look, every working class person I've met who we talk about this, they are outraged. The Republican elite, they're the ones who are outraged at someone. How dare they leak our private data? How dare they expose our cheating and our criming? How dare they? That's our private information. We should be able to cheat and crime in private. Which is why Joe Biden has said, look, we need to spend $80 billion over the next 10 years to put money into investigating. A mandatory flow of money into bringing in people who are going to hold the wealthy accountable and make them pay their share. Now, what's interesting is the number that they've come out with is really eye-popping. Because you go, we're going to spend $80 billion to go track down these tax cheats. They're saying they think that there's $700 billion out there over the next decade that we're being cheated out of. And I would argue it's probably higher than that. But I would also argue that the fact that we've given them this money, they've, again, lie, cheat, and lobby. They have lobbied to create a tax code that is exactly the way they want it. And we need revenue. And there's a lot of ways that we could be going after that revenue. I keep saying we need a much, much higher corporate tax rate. We need to make sure the Jeff Bezoses of the world pay their share. Because understand, corporate taxes, that's how shareholders end up paying taxes. That's where that's targeted. So when we say, no, we can't make them pay. No, those are the exact people we want to have to pay. We need a consumption tax. So when Jeff Bezos buys a $500 million boat, we go, yeah, we're going to tax that. That's what we need to be doing. Now, with a consumption tax, and I know a lot of people are like, oh, that's a regressive tax. We can do like Pennsylvania has done. Exclude food and clothing so that working class families don't get socked with it. But I'm telling you, you know, $5,000 suits, a fifth home, you know, these are things we should be taxing like crazy. This is where we get the revenue we need to build the stuff that we need. Also, I think we need a stock transaction tax. I think we need to, every stock trade that happens, when it happens, we put a couple pennies on that to ultimately bring some of that in. And the other side of it is we need a death tax. I know the Republicans have spent a lot of time on making us hate the death tax. You know, the only things that are certain are death and taxes. Well, you know, that's how we get people who have spent a lifetime of cheating the system by not realizing the stocks that they've been holding and borrowing against and leveraging so they didn't have to pay taxes. That's how you get some of that back. And I look at someone like the guy who paid the first estate tax, John D. Rockefeller. He was our first billionaire. He paid a 70% tax rate. And guess what? There are still rich Rockefellers to this day. So for me, the reality is we can do smart things. We need to do smart things. And we need a wealth class that's paying their share. And yes, it's a big share. But guess what? They've got all the money. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. More American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win.
On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day striking steelworkers battled back-to-work forces at Newton Steel in Monroe, Michigan. Steelworkers were on strike against three steel companies across five states in the push to organize Little Steel. Of the three, Republic Steel sites had experienced brutal picket line violence, especially in South Chicago. Republic had recently purchased Newton Rolling Mill. Management there was bent on forcing the reopening of the plant. John L. Lewis promised 8,000 to 10,000 workers from Detroit to bolster picket lines. The mayor of Monroe, Daniel Nags, called upon all able-bodied men with military experience to enlist in a citizens' army to escort scabs back to work. Police and hundreds of deputies set up checkpoints on the outskirts of the city to stop suspected CIO supporters from entering Monroe. Black SWAC organizer Leonides McDonald from Chicago had already been dragged from his car, beaten, and driven from town on foot by scabs earlier in the day. At the same time, Mayor Nags, company officials, as well as SWAC and company union organizers, met in the state's capital with Governor Murphy to negotiate a settlement. As they met, 200 more special police were sworn in and instructed in the use of sidearms and tear gas. Police deputies and scabs armed with guns, clubs, and tear gas shattered the picket line that evening. Then deputies seized strikers' cars and drove them into the river. 18 strikers were hospitalized. Outraged UAW supporters from Pontiac declared a labor holiday in protest and headed to Monroe. But UAW officials ordered them to turn back in an effort to stem the anti-union violence. The organizing drive had been dealt another serious setback.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news. The House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee passed a $547 billion package early this morning, aimed at doing what we've been talking about, fixing our roads and bridges. My problem, again, keeps from coming back to the Senate, who's saying, no, we're going to protect the wealthy. We're not going to raise taxes to pay for it. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to build dirt roads and put tolls on them. That's really, really problematic. But this is a good start. This package that they have passed, I think, is a good start and hopefully going to move us in a direction that we need to get into, which is why it's called the Invest in America Act. And here to share some thoughts on, are we really going to invest, or is this just going to be another one of those things that goes to the Senate and dies a sad, disastrous death? And here to share some thoughts, I've asked Greg Regan to come talk with us. Greg's the Secretary Treasurer of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Invest in America. Who could possibly be against that?
Look, I don't think anybody's really against it. I think everybody recognizes the need to invest in our infrastructure. What we've seen recently is a disagreement over the definition of what actually is infrastructure. And that's, I think that is a little petty at times. And frankly, it misses the point about what we're trying to accomplish. But the House passed, the T&I committee yesterday passed a really good bill, this morning, actually. But it's got a lot of stuff that we really care about. It would make huge investments into transit and passenger rail, highways and bridges, electric vehicle infrastructure. It's a good bill that would help every single state and every single district in this country.
Does it have pipes in it? I know the governor of South Dakota was quite distressed that there would be something that had pipes in it.
Yeah. I mean, I would have to look at what the pipeline infrastructure looks like, but let's be clear. I mean, nothing in this bill. And I know that there was a lot of talk from the other side. It's like, it's a Green New Deal. It's all a Green New Deal. That's a disingenuous argument. This is about investing in our existing infrastructure and finding a way to make sure that we can compete on emerging technology and emerging infrastructure.
Right.
And frankly, this is a really good start.
No, I see. My mind didn't go to pipelines with her. My mind went to she probably didn't have indoor plumbing at some point. And, because she was talking about housing and plumbing or housing and pipes. And I'm going, that's infrastructure. It's a physical thing. It's there. I get the argument against broadband because we can't see it in the sky. And evidently, we're going to find out later, it causes us to become like magnets. So that's coming.
Oh, man.
Would you, again, that's the right response. We have become such a weird kind of country in this moment where we can't agree that I got a pothole out front. Can we get that filled, please? We can't even agree on that anymore.
Yeah. And look, the good news is I do think we've changed a bit of we've turned the corner a little bit on the broader infrastructure debate. Whereas we used to have the discussion about whose role it was. There were a lot of people in Congress. There are still some, but there were a lot of people on the right in particular who thought that we should do devolution. We'll put the states in charge of everything. They're the ones who should fund it. The federal government shouldn't have any role here, and the state should do it all. And that has shifted. The real policymakers, even on the Republican side, the conversation's now more about how do we pay for it. And for a while there, they were saying that we can't raise the gas tax because that's raising taxes. And now the Democrats are saying, we'll fund it by repealing some of the corporate tax breaks that happened under the Trump administration. You see the Republicans now saying, whoa, we need a user fee. And it's like, well, that's what we were talking about before. So, like, I think that it's sort of the shifting of the window there. We're starting to see the conversation move in a better direction. The Senate is a little bit trickier, as you mentioned, because we've got not only is it a slower body and a more, the deliberative body. It has so many committees that are responsible for different pieces of this bill. The Senate Banking Committee has the transit title. You've got Finance Committee that has a role to play in this. You've got Senate Commerce that's going to do the passenger rail and anything that deals with aviation and like the buses, Greyhound buses stuff. And all of them are going to have their own individual piece, but they're moving and they're starting to talk about this seriously. And the Senate Commerce Committee is going to move their rail title hopefully next week. And, you know, we may be able to actually do something here.
Is this a big enough bill? I know, you know, Joe Biden had said we wanted, you know, a much bigger package. Does this move us in the direction of where Biden's vision is? Because, look, I'm of the mindset, you know, we need a really big, chunky, massive investment to make up for, you know, decades long of disinvestment. I look at the American Society of Civil Engineers report, who said, you know, we, what do we need? Something like $4 trillion at this point just to get even, not to be the world's best, to just get even. This is a lot of money, but it doesn't quite get us to where the folks there at the American Society of Civil Engineers thinks we need to go.
So I think we're talking about two different things in a way here. The Biden plan, the American Jobs Plan, which we've endorsed, we think is puts an appropriate amount of money into all of our infrastructure. You know, $80 billion for passenger rail would be an incredible investment. That may still not quite be enough, but it means that we could fix some very, you know, century-old infrastructure that needs to be fixed, and do it in a quick way, in an effective way, really invest in transit systems, really invest in airports, intermodal facilities, ports, all that stuff. The American Jobs Plan, that is more of a stimulus-style, one-time, massive infusion of funds into our system. That's not what Peter DeFazio's committee marked up yesterday. What they're doing is a surface reauthorization, and they're going to have to be they're always going to be linked, because really what you're talking about is resetting the bar, raising the floor with the jobs plan. And then the 5-year or 6-year reauthorization that we're talking about with the Invest Act, that's following through on it and establishing a longer term plan for how we invest in all of our systems. And frankly, I think they have to be hand in hand, but we're still talking about slightly different things.
No, I understand they're different, but at the end of the day, that you're still going to have a number, and that number is not going to be as big as we need. That's the point I was making, that you've got the,
it's true.
You've got this organization who's saying, look, you know, we've evaluated the infrastructure of the country, and this is what we think it's going to cost. We're not talking in those terms. We're talking in percentages of those terms.
That's true, but we, you know, that if we're talking, if we're going from the baseline of the American Jobs Plan, and if we get 80% of that, 80% in terms of the funding dollars, that is still the most that we've spent as a government in decades.
Right.
You know. So, and we're going back to the Great Depression in terms of the amount of money you're talking about investing in infrastructure, maybe the Eisenhower era, but you know, that would be a huge step in the right direction, and one that could solve a lot of our immediate problems here.
Now, one of the things that I was surprised at, any of these transportation bills, I always make sure that somebody didn't get a little crafty and figure out a way to strip prevailing wage out of the bill. Still front and center. Because look, the other day we had the innovation bill that, you know, is pointed at being more competitive with China. You had John Cornyn, the Texas senator, who threw it out there, and you got 8 Republicans to vote to leave prevailing wage in that bill. I was surprised that there wasn't a vote on this as well.
Well, I think especially in the House, they realized they've lost that one. I mean, there was an amendment to strip out Davis-Bacon in their prevailing wage laws. We have, you know, upwards of 40 Republicans who are going to vote for that, let alone Democrats. There's no bad Democratic votes. But I do think that the voice of the Biden administration, you know, what the president talks about when he releases the American Jobs Plan, and he name checks all of the important labor protection laws that we have in this country, whether it be prevailing wage, Davis-Bacon, PLAs, 13C on the transit side, Buy America provisions, cargo preference, you know, all of the things that we really care about that the president is proudly talking about and understanding and making the case for why that benefits our country. That gives everybody a lot of cover. We're not having those fights right now. And especially with someone like Peter DeFazio, who's been a friend of ours for a very long time, all of those things are in that bill. And that's a big reason why we're out there vocally supporting it.
No, again, you know, it's one of those reasons that I bring up so that my union listeners, they go, look, it's there. It's kind of like that, you know, like when you flip over the bread and you look for the union label. It's there. It's in there. but the other thing is, you brought it up here a second ago, was the Buy American provision, which for me, you know, I look at, you know, the tale of two bridges, the one out in California and the one in New York. One, we chose to go the route of using, you know, a project labor agreement. We used prevailing wage labor. We had Buy American provisions in that. It was done on time, under budget, and is a fantastic, well-built bridge. And then out in California, you got the one we went the China route with because, hey, it might be cheaper, and we find out it's never going to be done. And it was actually had massive cost overruns. And again, did I mention it's never actually going to be done? That's a problem and a lesson, I think, that I hope we've learned.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, this is one area where, frankly, the politics have shifted dramatically in the last 10 years. I mean, I remember that Bay Bridge, where you're talking about in California, was one of the first things I worked on, or one of the earlier issues I worked on when I joined TTD a decade ago. And, you know, at the time, we had a lot of opposition about trying to fix the loophole, the segmentation loophole, which is what allowed them to do that. We got it done, but there was some opposition even among Democrats. And now the Republicans are, you know, trying to out, you know, buy America the Democrats. So we actually have an opportunity to do good policy. You know, a lot of the proposals coming from the other side aren't very good, and they're filled with loopholes, and there's a lot of corporate favoritism that's in there. But on the Democratic side, we have a chance to supplement Buy America laws, which are just, you know, setting domestic content with things like community benefits agreements, U.S. employment plan language, in a way to actually make sure that not only we're making it here, but we're making it with good middle class union jobs.
No, and this is where, you know, I talk a lot about the fact that if we're going to make these kind of investments, we're going to spend this kind of money, it should lift up all the boats. That whole, you know, rising tide thing that people like to talk about. The sad reality is, as the tide rises, Jeff Bezos's $500 million boat is crushing everybody's little dinghies into the shore. So, you know, that benefit really isn't there, which is why I'm glad to see that there's a commitment to say, look, you know, we're going to make sure that everyone does better.
Yeah, it's always been common sense. If we want to make sure that we're going to spend public money, taxpayer money on stuff, we should make sure it's reinvested back into our communities. And that's really what this is about. And if we want to make sure that we expand our tax base and make sure that we expand opportunities, we should expand the opportunity for unions, have better benefits, and incentivize companies who are going to be bidding on procurement stuff. So whether it be trains or buses or even defense contract stuff, that part of the incentive should not be how low can we get in terms of costs and how can we squeeze out as much out of our workforce we can. But if we're incentivizing them to actually have good jobs, provide good benefits, have training opportunities so there's a ladder for career advancement involved in these jobs, and you can build that into the contract to incentivize that behavior, that's going to benefit us as a country.
No, I'm right there with you. But for me, I don't know if it's – I hate the sound of being hyper-nationalistic. But on a certain level, we've got to, if we're building it here, we've got to, if we're putting up the bridge, we should be creating the steel and the cement and all the things that go into it. If we're rebuilding our transit system, we should be making the cars here with American labor and done by American corporations. And this is where I get into some trouble, because the only real cars that are being built are by a Chinese corporation. Yeah, they're here. But yeah, I'm struggling with the communist Chinese government owning a company that makes our transit systems, or am I being overly nationalistic?
Well, look, I don't think you're being overly nationalistic, but at the same time, I think we ceded that manufacturing base decades ago when it comes to things like rolling stock, because, you know, I will correct you that there's only one company that's making.
There's two.
These trains. Oh, there's Siemens, but that's a German company. There's Kawasaki, that's a Japanese company. There's Alstom, that's a French company. Bombardier is a Canadian company. They all have facilities here, and they're all competing for these things. And, you know, Alstom is a union company, and they're not far from where I grew up in upstate New York. But the point is that none of them are American companies. And that just reflects that where we were, where our priorities were at the time when we had an opportunity to maintain our leadership in railcar manufacturing, we chose not to. And our policies reflect that. And we have an opportunity, especially with new technology, when you're talking about things like electric vehicles and you're talking about the next generation of high-speed rail. All this stuff means you're creating, there's going to be a new market, and we have an opportunity through solid government policy to reclaim that manufacturing base. And I think it'd be good. It's going to be good for us if we can actually successfully do that.
No, that's where I was going. I was tripping along. I was stumbling along, and you cleaned it up, and that's a good thing. Because at the end of the day, look, I believe in domestic production for domestic consumption. We build the things that we need, and we benefit from them, not just by having good quality products, but people having good quality jobs and having better lives. To me, it's that simple. Now, you brought up the new technologies because, look, I know Mitch McConnell said that, you know, all of these bills are, you know, a liberal wish list, or I forget how he put it, a liberal parade or something. But we are going to be moving to electric vehicles, and we do need infrastructure to be able to accommodate that, and we do need to invest in it. That just seems like, well, not a liberal wish list, but common sense. That's where we're going.
Yeah, and you know, people are, we're going, nobody wants to have to go to the gas station all the time. I mean, I think the idea that people are going to be hesitant to get electric vehicles is, I mean, I think the market is driving it right now. It's not like there's a huge amount of our, you know, government interference forcing people to buy Teslas or buy the newest hybrids or, you know, whatever the electric vehicles are. People want to do that. They want to.
Yeah, I want that new Ford Lightning.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds great. But we do need to have the infrastructure across the country so that this becomes a viable option to do the type of travel that Americans do. And we should be, heck, you want to make us the most competitive and the leader in the world on these things? Then let's set up the infrastructure to allow that to happen.
Absolutely.
And then also make sure that we can make them here.
I'm right there with you.
Those are all important parts.
Last question I've got for you. How do we help move this along? What's the marching order out of all this? How do you see this going through?
Well, I think, first of all, we need the Senate to act. We're going to need if you feel like calling your member of Congress, calling your senator and saying, go pass this bill. We need infrastructure now. Do it. This is, in my view, it's been the can that's been kicked down the road for 40 years. And we have an opportunity right now with the president who has made it his number one priority to do something big that will make a difference for generations to come. Call your members of Congress, talk about, this isn't a partisan issue. This is an issue that is critical for our country. And if you want to talk about in competition, the threat of, you know, the looming Chinese threat and all that stuff, you know what we can do to actually solve this problem is invest in ourselves. And that's what I think this bill will do and what I think the American Jobs Plan will do.
Good stuff. Greg, I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Good stuff. Greg Regan, Secretary Treasurer of the Transportation Trades Department there of the AFL-CIO. Check out their website, TTD.org. We'll get links out.
United we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day that the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that would have massive implications for American workers. The case was known as Anderson v. Mount Clemens Pottery. The pottery company was operated on a large 8-acre property in Mount Clemens, Michigan. Each day, the workers punched into their shifts and then had to make their way to their workstations. There, they had to get ready to work, perhaps donning gloves, sharpening tools, or readying their workstations. The company estimated that these tasks took 14 minutes. So, they subtracted 14 minutes from the workers' timesheets each day. Seven workers had had enough and decided to sue the company, with backing from their union. They argued that they should be compensated for their entire time, including the time it took to prepare for work. The Supreme Court agreed with the workers. Justice Frank Murphy wrote the decision for the court. He himself was from Michigan and had previously been the mayor of Detroit and the governor of the state. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court case was not the last word on the matter. In 1994, the State Bar of Michigan and the Macomb County Bar Association helped erect a historic marker commemorating this important case. It described what happened after Justice Murphy's determination. Quote, the following year, Congress, responding to the Mount Clemens Pottery decision, enacted the Portal to Portal Act to relieve employers of the obligation to pay for time spent in non-productive activities, except where such activities are compensable through custom or contract, notably through collective bargaining. In other words, Congress passed a law undermining the court's protection of workers.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday on the program, we talked a little bit about this this physician from Cleveland who evidently during an Ohio House hearing came up with the idea that somehow the mixture of the vaccine, whatever's in the vaccine, combined with the airwaves of the 5G technology somehow creates like a superhero kind of thing where you're now magnetic. In fact, you know, the Twitters went crazy with people filling themselves with spoons and knives and all kinds of metallic things, because I guess we're all metallic now. But the weird thing is there's so many of these conspiracies out there. And the sad thing is somebody thought this was a good idea to bring to a House hearing. So just when I thought Pennsylvania was the craziest state in the country, my former home state of Ohio, you're doing a great job keeping up. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the House hearing that happened yesterday in the Health Committee there in Ohio. I've asked Jake Zuckerman to come talk with us. Jake's a journalist at the Ohio Capital Journal, their website, ohiocapitaljournal.com. Jake, thanks for taking time for us.
No, thanks for having me on.
So am I getting this right? I mean, you got this woman, her name was Tenpenny, Dr. Tenpenny, who came out with this idea that, if you got this vaccine, there's something in it, it reacts with the 5G, now we're all magnetized. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, you got it right. I think the context is important. You know, I think that this bill that she was there to speak on behalf of and speak in support of was, it's a pretty across-the-board weakening of vaccination laws. And there was so much interest that they actually narrowed testimony to select witnesses. I'm not totally sure how they were selected, but the point is, this: she was invited. You know, she was told to come, and this wasn't out of the blue. She is full of fringe theories and all kinds of. If you just give her name a Google, I mean, some of the history out there is pretty shocking, and it really raises some questions about why was this person invited. But yes, she came and she talked all about the risks that vaccinated people pose to unvaccinated people. There were claims involving 5G towers and magnetic waves, and. You know, I want to emphasize this is nonsense. These are not serious claims. These are not real health risks to be aware of. But they were shared to lawmakers as they consider this real weakening of vaccination laws.
Yeah, and I guess she wasn't the only one. I mean, when you open up a hearing like this, you're going to get all of the, and as you've said, there were probably a line of people who wanted to come and share their nonsense. But, you know, this is what we're supposed to do. This is what these hearings are for, I guess, no?
I would argue no. These hearings are for taking expertise and hearing from expert witnesses or ordinary citizens. If citizens want to testify to their experience as citizens, sure. If you want to hear from an expert on vaccination laws, that's a great idea. But what I think gets dangerous is when you bring people in and you identify them as experts, and then you just let them go, kind of like she did. And it embarrasses the state. You know, if we're just being realistic, Ohio is kind of a joke right now, and everyone's putting pictures of keys on their foreheads, you know, and what have we gained? Yeah. There was no actual accomplishment of science there. Nobody learned anything about science. It was just a mockery.
But I'll bet everybody did, you know, take some metal and on the spot where they got the vaccine just to check.
I did it. I
hesitated walking by the drawer where the knives are, you know, just in case, you know, and I'm sure there's going to be some kook story out there that said, no, somebody got stabbed. But this is the weird thing, because, you know, you hear these stories and someone gives them a platform to come out and say this. I mean, as you pointed out in your piece, you had a pastor who was running around saying that, you know, they put formaldehyde and fetal cells in the vaccines, which, you know, is really a stretch from the reality of the stem cell research that went into this.
Yeah, I mean, you said just the right word. It's giving a platform. We know these things are untrue, and we can play this whack-a-mole game of correcting each vaccine myth we hear. But at a certain point, you got to look at the source, and you have to wonder, how do these completely incorrect ideas disseminate? And I think it's a very complicated answer, but an easy way to cut it off would be stop giving people the TV cameras that are in the state house. You know, only invite people you know to be experts. And if you want to bring a pastor to give some kind of religious testimony or how, I don't know how this relates to a church or a religious group, sure, but there's a real problem when you're inviting religious figures like rabbis or priests to give scientific testimony about a scientific issue like vaccination.
Yeah, I kind of had, you know, I went the other way. You know, the scientific part is one part of it. I don't expect the pastor to be, you know, all that, you know, knowledgeable on the science. You know, maybe he watched a couple of YouTube videos and he got an idea, maybe from Dr. Tenpenny. But, you know, I would go from that whole Ten Commandment thing, you know, thou shalt not bear false witness. You would think they would know that to come into a public hearing and to, well, just, you know, make something up. I mean, it's kind of frightening.
Yeah, it is frightening. And it's easy to let, you know, I'd be lying if I acted like there's no humor in the whole situation. But the reality is these are things that people believe.
Yeah.
People are worried about unvaccinated people who are at real risk of COVID-19 right now are now worrying about magnetic waves from vaccinated people. I mean, the fact that people are willing to believe something like that is a problem. And the fact that it will continue to keep them from vaccination is a problem for everyone. It's not just a problem for them.
Yeah. The thing that gets me is, you know, I at one point thought we were probably a little bit more educated than this. A lot of people have graduated from high school. A lot of people have gone on to college. You would think that with a base of knowledge that most people should possess, that a lot of this conspiracy theory, a lot of this stuff would be filtered out. But I guess when you're spending 10,000 hours with your mouth open watching YouTube videos and calling it research, as Dr. Tenpenny said, maybe the sleep deprivation puts you in that position.
Sure. I'd point out that the vaccines are kind of a tough sell. You know, I mean, if they're the fact that we don't think about these diseases is really proof of their efficacy. You know, nobody has to worry about measles anymore. Americans don't get like polio. Polio is just not a consideration here because we've vaccinated it out of the country. But when you let these ideas proliferate and then they're used to support legislation like House Bill 248, and then all of a sudden fewer people are getting polio shots, it's not rocket science. The fewer people that are vaccinated against polio, the more likely it is that a polio outbreak happens. And these diseases still circulate.
No, you're absolutely right. And but you bring up an interesting point, though, because during the Trump era, during the former guy's era, there was talk of, you know, just allowing it to rage and we'd get herd immunity because people would get it. And it took me back to when I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, I got mumps, measles, chicken pox. I got all those things. You know, mom was nice enough to take me over to go play with some friends until I got sick. Thanks, mom. I didn't get the vaccines. But, you know, it's one of those things where you start going, well, is that a viable option? And you go, you know, not when it's going to kill off an entire generation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should all be starting off from the same place that sickness and hospitalization and death are bad. And it doesn't always feel like we're all coming from that same place. But I just think it's a really important place to go from is that you don't want diseases circulating in your communities. Yeah. You don't want a measles threat where your children go to school.
Especially when you have the opportunity to do something about it. And this is where, you know, we're in a moment in history where science can do some things. And look, we have seen that this vaccine has been extremely safe. I mean, we haven't heard huge numbers of people having really adverse side effects. Most of us don't know anyone who's had adverse side effects, although all of us, I think, have known somebody who was really sick with COVID, and a lot of us know people who have passed. So for me, it's almost kind of a no-brainer. We protect ourselves and we protect others. That's my problem in this. You've got these folks who, you know, they've got it in their mind that, well, I'm not going to do it, and the hell with you. To me, that's also a problem.
Yeah, and you got to remember, I mean, some people, they can't, I mean, they can get vaccinated, but the vaccine won't take, they won't develop antibodies. Some people cannot take vaccinations. So some people have very weak immune systems, and the concept of herd immunity is that the whole herd will keep you safe. If enough of the herd is vaccinated,
right,
the disease just runs out of hosts. And, you know, there used to be, I think, a lot more civic buy-in on that idea, and then the concept of health has gotten a lot more individualistic. I think the conservative ethos has sort of rippled outward on that. So people think of vaccination as something I can choose to do and keep myself safe, or I can choose not to, but not just about you. It is about you as a vector to spread disease along with you as a host of disease.
Now, do you think it's, again, this is a construct of the era in which we live in, where social media is so powerful and we're such a polarized country politically, where, you know, even my son said, you know, it's sad that, you know, my generation looks at someone waving an American flag and we think of immediately Trump supporter or crazy right winger. And it shouldn't be that way. You see someone with a mask on, it's almost a political statement as opposed to a public health statement. I think it has more to do with the time in which we live in.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you're just asking for my opinion, I think staying home during the pandemic was a patriotic thing to do. I think going to get vaccinated to keep our communities free from disease is a patriotic thing to do. You know, it doesn't get wrapped into that like zeitgeist of flag thumping patriotism, but I think that really is the good civilian thing to do in a pandemic.
So now this legislation, House Bill 248, is this moving through? I mean, I look at places like Florida and Texas, who are in the process of saying, you know what, you can't ask anybody if they've been vaccinated. You can't do anything to them. Businesses, you have to allow unvaccinated people in. Don't have to sell the gay couple the cake, but the unvaccinated guy who's going to get you sick, you got to let him in. How is this moving?
So it's gotten a couple of hearings quickly, and the chairman, after Dr. Tenpenny's after that hearing, said that there were two more on the docket. I wouldn't rule out a change in the plans after the kind of attention that something like this has gotten, and not favorable attention. You know, that might scuttle the calculations a bit. But yeah, this thing really was moving. The chairman wanted to get it out of his committee by the end of the month, which is when the legislature breaks for the summer. So I don't think they're kidding around with this stuff. And, you know, they passed Senate Bill 22 a few months ago, which was I'd call across the board weakening of our public health laws, not our vaccination laws. And they proved their willingness and ability to override the governor's veto on this. So I wouldn't sleep on something like this. I wouldn't write off its chances.
Yeah. And the weird thing is you've got a Republican governor. So, you know, your legislature, your general has gone even further than he is. And to me, that's a little concerning as well. It seems like you're going really off the rails.
Mm-hmm. And I'd point out today, I read this in the Columbus Dispatch, that Mike DeWine has broken his silence on House Bill 248 and came out with some comments against it. The effect, and his comments were reflective of his age. He brought up polio, and he said, I remember when this was a huge problem, and it's not a problem anymore, and that's because of vaccines, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
Yeah, my generation was the first one that didn't have to worry about that. But people a little bit older than me, you know, they tell the story. Look, you know, they knew people who suffered from polio, and because we vaccinated and did it in a way where, like you said, it's a patriotic thing. You know, we don't have that nowadays. Do you think I guess the question that I have is, do you think that, you know, you go back to through the beginning of this, that people were surviving? So, you know, I know a bunch of people who think they had it. Oh yeah, I had that back, you know, months before everybody else did. And they think they got through it. It wasn't a big deal. Do you think that had a lot to do with the reaction, or was this just, in your opinion, just purely a political, I'm on one side of the fence, you're on the other side, and we're going to choose our sides.
You know, I mean, I think if you look at the data, there's definitely some evidence of a partisan split here on vaccination. I don't think that's the whole picture. You know, I think that that's certainly driving a piece of it. But frankly, people my age aren't getting vaccinated. I think that's less of a political thing than them seeing COVID as not a risk and just not really buying into the whole patriotism vis-a-vis vaccines idea. You know, I think there's some people who just can't get off work or can't risk feeling crappy for a day. And we have an economic system that doesn't give everyone paid time off or doesn't give people the time to go get vaccines. I think like 20% of Ohioans don't have a car, so there's no vaccine provider within walking distance or on a bus route, then what? So I think there are access problems, but yeah, I think you got to really have blinders on to be missing the political split here on the back data.
Now, you know, what you talk about your generation is, you know, not, you know, maybe not doing it. And I would think you're a young guy. I mean, you know, the survivability of getting it at your age is clearly something that you're going to take into consideration, because, you know, when I was your age, middle 20s, I was invincible. I was bulletproof. That was my mindset. So I guess I'm not so surprised at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, only speaking for me here, but what really scared me was the idea of seeding an outbreak. You know, if I got COVID, I mean, I might not be fine, but I'll probably be fine. But when you read some of these medical reports, the stories are all kind of the same. Someone is doing the stuff they know they shouldn't do. before symptoms catch in or an asymptomatic carrier, but either way they go in, a bunch of people in whatever bar or wedding they went to get COVID, it ripples out, someone's grandparents died. I mean, do you want that? Do you want that to happen? Do you want that on you?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I guess it shows how we are as a society where, you know, for decades, we've been talking about hooray for me and the heck with everybody else. Greed is good. The one who dies with the most toys wins. This hooray for me culture. And this, I guess this just is, you know, part of how that's manifested. So what can we expect going forward with Ohio? What's the next bit of craziness that we can expect that we should be keeping an eye on?
Well, I mean, there's a budget moving and virtually anything and everything can find its way into a budget. I think House Bill 248 is a pretty big deal. You know, one thing we haven't touched on here is that Ohio schools already have fairly weak vaccination laws. They say that you can exempt yourself from vaccination laws by reasons of conscience. And this bill would basically require schools to amplify the word about that exemption and make sure every parent knows it.
So have they gone the route to where the schools can't mandate the vaccine yet?
That is a part. Actually, no, I take it back. It's not a part of the bill. No, so school vaccine, because that's its own separate section of code. So colleges would not be able to mandate the vaccine under the bill. But no, schools would still be able to mandate it, but would have to honor the exemptions for reasons of conscience, which is kind of a catch-all term.
Because we saw a story just recently where a medical facility is laying off, you know, like 150, 170 people who aren't getting vaccinated or haven't, and have said, look, if you don't get it, you're fired. And our law allows that. Is there something moving in Ohio that's going to undo that like we see in other states?
It's funny you mentioned that. Also in House Bill 248, it would ban hospitals or nursing homes from requiring that their employees get vaccinated. I mean, that's not just a thing that's specifically written into the bill, is hospitals and nursing homes. So, you know, you want to talk about a vulnerable population where vaccines might not take, where you really got to hope that nobody's carrying that virus around. Nursing homes would be exempt from any sort of compulsory vaccination laws.
Crazy, crazy stuff, but I'm glad you're there to report on it. And thank you for sharing the tenpenny story. I got a lot of laughs out of it, but also a lot of concerns. But keep up the great work there at the Ohio Capital Journal. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Reading anytime.
Good stuff. Jake Zuckerman. Make sure you check out his work, capitaljournal.com, the website. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act. The goal of the act was to end wage discrimination against women. It required equal pay for equal work. One of the leading advocates of the act was Esther Peterson. At the time, Esther was the highest-ranking woman in President Kennedy's administration. She headed the Women's Bureau for the Department of Labor. In 1981, President Ronald Reagan awarded Esther the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor. She was recognized for a lifetime of tireless work for women, workers, and consumers, including her efforts on behalf of the Equal Pay Act. It certainly was an uphill battle to pass the legislation. Similar proposals had failed to make it through Congress for nearly two decades. Many business interests lined up in opposition. Finally, in 1963, there was enough momentum to pass the landmark legislation. At the signing, President Kennedy reflected on the significance of the measure, saying, "While much remains to be done to achieve full equality of economic opportunity, for the average woman worker earns only 60% of the average wage for men, this legislation is a significant step forward. Our economy today depends upon women in the labor force. One out of every three workers is a woman. Today, there are almost 25 million women employed, and their number is rising faster than the number of men in the labor force. The act had a profoundly positive impact for women workers.
Yet today, that impact remains incomplete. Women still only make about 80% of the average wage for men. It is up to today's labor leaders to complete Esther's fight for true pay equality. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.